We're going to begin with more signs that the upcoming Winter Olympics will be a showcase for Russia's security forces and a showcase for Russian President Vladimir Putin's broader ambitions in Europe. NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, it was originally set up as a strategic alliance to contain Russian ambitions for expansion in Europe. Today, though, NATO is more concerned with Afghanistan. NATO forces are part of the coalition fighting the Taliban. But will that focus have to change now? On Tuesday, President Obama spoke with Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin, offering the full assistance of the White House in dealing with terrorist threats in advance of the Sochi Winter Games. Putin has ordered a call-up of tens of thousands of security personnel to raise the police presence in Russia for the Games to basically twice what Britain had in place for the London Summer Games 2 years ago. Once upon a time, Soviet Russia considered its control of Eastern Europe an essential buffer against foreign threats. And today, there is trouble in the old buffer zone. In Ukraine, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has warned that protests in Kiev are getting out of control. We've had reports of the first fatalities of protesters. Instability in Eastern Europe was the focus for NATO when General Wesley Clark was the NATO Supreme Allied Commander back in the 90s. In a wide-ranging conversation in Washington about Europe, intelligence gathering, and the future of the Pentagon, Clark said that Vladimir Putin's designs on Ukraine were apparent to him more than two decades ago at the inauguration of Ukraine's then-president, Leonid Kuchma, when Putin was just the Russian prime minister. Clark recalled clearly something Putin said about the relationship between the two countries.
Ukraine and Russia are more than brothers. We are in each other's souls. The Polish National Security Advisor came to me when I was at NATO and said he was very worried about this because it indicated the pattern of Russian effort and that they would attempt to regain control of Ukraine. There's been a number of economic ploys done this, and throughout Eastern Europe, we know that there's a certain effort that's underway by Russian intelligence services working through a number of different channels that make democracy difficult to function. It's not necessarily that they want to take over the country or even to destabilize it. They want it in their orbit. They still play geostrategic chess. We don't, but they do.
We'll hear more of my conversation with General Wesley Clark in just a moment. But first, let's turn to Andrew Weiss, Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, former staff member at the National Security Council. Andrew Weiss, welcome to The Takeaway.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So what do you make of General Clark's suggestion that Vladimir Putin still thinks of Eastern Europe as something of a buffer zone and that Russians generally are inclined to be very, very worried about what's going on in Ukraine?
I think what's going on in Ukraine is quite dramatic at the moment. The situation we've seen today in terms of reports of people being killed, of the police and the army moving on these protesters who've been camped out in the center of Kiev, very alarming. The question of who's responsible and why things have come to this, I think, is murky at this point. I think we know that there's been a dramatic battle underway in terms of a country that is split. There are two parts of Ukraine. There's a part of the country which wants closer relations with Russia, and then there's a less urbanized part of the country in the West which wants a sort of more European outlook. But to sort of say this is all part of some big geopolitical conspiracy and that there's this big geopolitical battle, I think, is a bit of a stretch.
Although, if things get unstable in Ukraine, is it the case that Vladimir Putin has a tradition of thinking of this part of the world as his sort of strategic playground, that they would be inclined to take unilateral action in Ukraine where they might not elsewhere in the world?
The Ukrainian government for the past 20 years has been very adept at using both sides, both the West and the Russians, to wheedle as many credits, cash, and concessions out of both, and to basically muddle along. And what seems to have happened this time was really part of that playbook. The president of Ukraine is facing re-election. He's very unpopular. The country's economy is in terrible shape. And he basically played both sides off against each other in the hope of getting as much support as he could for his own re-election campaign. What happened in the week since that set of deals were struck is that the situation on the ground got more and more tense. The government kept pushing the demonstrators to clear the square, and then things seem to have just gotten out of control over the past couple of days. Go ahead.
Andrew Weiss, what do you think the Olympics does to either exacerbate this, intensify this, or any other conflict going on in Russia right now?
I think that everything in Russia has been basically put on hold to get ready for these Olympic Games. Putin sees them as a showcase both for Russia's role on the international stage, but also as a way to demonstrate to the Russian people that he's delivering for them. I think in the end, this has proved to be probably a counterproductive move for Putin in the sense that Russia has had to pour tens of billions of dollars into the Sochi Games to try to get things ready, to try to build the infrastructure down there. And then, as you rightly pointed out at the top of the segment, to build the security structures in the region to create an atmosphere that the games can unfold peacefully. This is a tough neighborhood, and doing that with any level of confidence is going to be very challenging for the Russians.
And even though it's expensive, the Russians can afford it with oil prices this high. Andrew Weiss, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Andrew Weiss is Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and former staff member at the National Security Council. In our conversation yesterday, retired Army General Wesley Clark spoke about changes in Russia and Eurasia and wondered whether the U.S. is keeping up with those changes. He spoke about the difficulties of getting the Pentagon to change with the times. And in speaking about U.S. intelligence gathering in the wake of the NSA controversies and the Edward Snowden revelations, General Clark, who was once a Democratic Party presidential candidate, said surprisingly that he believes Americans put aside privacy in favor of electronic surveillance a long time ago.
I think that most Americans had an understanding that there was no privacy. But I think what's different is now it's been confirmed. And when you confirm it, it changes the quality of the expectation. Before you thought, if anything I put in writing, anything I say, there's someone could be listening. Now you know they are listening or at least have the capacity to do so. Now, when all of this broke, the reaction I got from most people was, so what? Not doing anything wrong. If listening to me makes America safer, let them listen. And so I think it's been difficult for the public outrage to be built on this. I think most Americans still say, well, the government's responsible for security. If this is what's required to secure us, okay. And I think in America today, the need for security is a compelling need. Look at it this way. Over 30,000 people a year are killed in fatal highway accidents. Almost 40,000 people are killed with guns. And it happens every day. It's reported every day. And nothing's done about it legislatively. People don't lose their offices because of it. But the tolerance for a significant terrorist incident is zero.
You've known Bob Gates, former defense secretary, for quite a long time. His memoir seems to describe a very frustrating experience in government, dealing with the government the way it operates today, even given his power at the Pentagon and in the intelligence establishment. Are you sympathetic with his frustrations, and do you think you would be as frustrated if you were in the same position that he was in two administrations?
Oh, I don't know that I could characterize the emotions that way or predict my own reactions to it, but I think it's a fascinating, it's a compelling, as well as a candid memoir, because as he acknowledges, he's fighting to get things done. Now, Secretary Gates was previously in the intelligence business, and so even as the director of the CIA for a period in the first Bush administration, he probably didn't have the same execution problems that those of us who've been in the military and worked in the Pentagon have grown up suffering. There's no question. This is a very difficult system to move. I thought it was just heart-wrenching to see how difficult it was for him to move, for example, to the mine-resistant armored protection vehicles, the MRAPs, that he managed to persuade Congress to give him the money for, and we bought them in the thousands and saved young men and women's lives and limbs with these, and it was exactly the right call. Of course, he's exactly right when he says that the Pentagon is, most of it when he got there, they weren't focused on the war, they were focused on the next war. Well, that's also part of the Pentagon's job. He said he was the only guy who was really focused on winning this war. So I think one of the strongest parts of the memoir is how Bob Gates was able to rise above the position. We have to thank him for it.
Do you agree that the mission in Afghanistan was unclear to him and that he was very troubled at not being able to convey that to the president?
Since I wasn't there, it's a little hard for me to get into the details of this. I think when he conveys President Obama's attitude and said maybe he wasn't, you know, fully committed to the mission as I thought he should be or something, if that was the implication in the book, I think, you know, it could have been an entirely different impression that Obama was giving off. For anyone who's president of the United States and sending men into war, especially into something that's a counterinsurgency, where you've got a huge country and you know that you don't have enough troops to really do the job. And even if you did have enough troops, you don't have enough of the rest of the stuff. You don't have enough trainers. You don't have enough agriculture specialists. You don't have enough education people. And even more than that, it takes three generations to change people's attitudes, whether it's attitudes toward voting, attitudes toward the desegregation and voting acts that went through the South, or something like the Vietnam carryover and how it's affected our population. These are not things that can be solved by a Madison Avenue campaign, by young social workers coming up and saying, patting on the back, say, hey, haven't you changed your mind? And they certainly can't be solved by 19 and 20-year-old Marines and paratroopers in Kevlar and sunglasses who can't speak the language.
In Afghanistan.
I think the president understood all of that when he had to make those decisions. He picked the least bad option, but that doesn't mean it's a good option. And I think that it's a tribute to Bob Gates. He saw it. It's a tribute to Barack Obama. He felt it, if that's what he felt.
General Wesley Clark was NATO's Supreme Allied Commander from 1997 to 2000. He now works as an advisor to the Global Panel Foundation and the National Security Network. He's also chairman of the investment bank, Rodman & Renshaw. Still to come, what did President Obama think about yesterday's snow day in Washington, D.C., and how the nation's capital responds to some flakes of snow? Coming up next, can Congress revisit the Voting Rights Act and update something the Supreme Court struck down last year? That's all coming up here on The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.